นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนมัสสามิSo some ideas there for those who are new to meditation or old to meditation. Having an hour or 45 minutes or something where you're actually devoting your time to observing consciousness and trying things out is very valuable on many, many levels. One is that one is justtaking some time not to constantly fill the mind, because so much of our time can be spent in processing information, dealing with our responsibilities, or just being distracted by various things in life. So there's a tendency in life to just be filling all the time, with the eyes taking in information, with the ears emotionally. Quite often we're taking on stuff, maybe complexities. So a time where one, and we all know this already, but just a time where one isn't just filling, one isn't taking on, one steps away from that into just being with what's happening. That's very, very valuable. One of the difficulties that arises in that, one of the nice things that arises, you just relax. Oh, great, nothing to do. But in that nothing to do, sometimes material comes up that hasn't been processed, say, one way to look at it, and that can be quite unpleasant. So even though you think, oh, great, I'll just have a nice time and meditate, it's sometimes not a nice time. You might get old memories and tiredness and different things come up. But the attitude in meditation is one where we're trying to be friendly with everything, whether it's sorrow or serenity, whether it's a strong emotion or no emotion, whether we feel like we want to meditate or we don't want to meditate, and whatever the movement of the heart and the mind is, the attitude of meditation is to this kind of friendly knowing, just knowing whatever's going on. And if we can train in that attitude for 45 minutes, which is quite hard, isn't it? You know, because we tend to be reacting. But if we can train for those 45 minutes in just that attitude of friendliness with the way things are, then we first of all notice that our resistance to that, where we want to get rid of something, or we constantly get obsessed with something. It might be some pleasant fantasy that some creative thing that we're doing, or some person we're going to see, some place we're going to be. So it could be on the kind of positive side, where our mind keeps going off to, or it could be a negative side, where we're trying to get rid of some emotion, or we're dealing with discomfort. It's a lot of meditation is just dealing with discomfort for people who are over 12. Whatever age, I'm sure. But if you just ponder this attitude. Now, this attitude, in theory, could be something that we could apply to every movement of consciousness, every bodily feeling, every emotion, every mental thing, because it's something we can evoke, we can bring forth. Now, this attitude of friendliness isn't that the same as liking? I mean, I don't like pain, and I don't like some of the emotional turmoil that might come up into my heart, or I might not like a person's the way they speak with me or whatever. But just to try to kind of just to stay friendly with the way things are, is this sense of acceptance and awareness of the way things are. So that's one of the basic attitudes that we're always trying to develop in the Buddhist practice. Now, if you see that friendliness is not necessarily the mood you're in, because I can be in an anxious mood about something maybe, and I can bring up, may I be free from anxiety? May I be friendly with anxiety? I can do that. I can evoke that. Not always, you know, but the more you do it, the better you get at it. So it's not like I feel great, but even this anxiety, even that, I'll be friendly with that. Or it might be more complicated. You know, maybe you're not on your own. You're in some social situation where, you know, the person that you're talking to is just getting up your nose or whatever part of you. And they're not doing anything necessarily wrong. It's just one of those human interactions. So you don't have to call them on it. You know, they're not abusing you. You know, there's all those issues, social issues. But just in the normal give and take of life, you know, people we find exasperating or annoying or irritating or frustrating, right? Now, the more we practice, we take time to practice this inner attitude of friendliness in a sitting of 45 minutes where it's not complex, you're not threatened, then that attitude of friendliness begins to take hold in those more complex situations of our life, like human interactions. And I think we've all seen that, where we might feel irritated with the way someone has just said something, or sort of inner tension, but we don't just blurt it out. We don't just dump on someone, but we don't have to repress it either. But we can do two things at once. We can be talking with someone and trying to practice right speech and not like them. We can do that. We're amazing, we human beings. Yeah, I can be speaking with someone and really not wanting to be speak with them. And, you know, my emotional life might be saying, I wish you'd go away. But my social life would be saying, well, that's not going to happen. Huh? And I can feel that in my heart, and I can still speak to that person in a decent way. Now, that's more tricky than just being on your cushion and dealing with sore knees. But it's the same principle. So if I'm sitting on the cushion and I'm dealing with sore knees and restlessness, right? I can know that, you know, sore knees, restlessness, I've seen that before, just hang in there, may I be well, may I be free, and the mind can be with those unpleasant things. So there's a strength there. There's a strength to be with the unpleasant. Now that strength, of course, then carries through into everything, because the mind is really one process. So then I go into that situation where the person gets up my eyebrows, or, you know, I just don't really like the person, but I'm more and more aware of my inner attitude now, the upwelling inside my being, right? My reactivity to the person. I make a choice to just stay with it, try to speak decently. What's the result? Well, the result is I don't create any more karma with that person. I don't create any resentments or remorse or regret. I walk away from it clean. Whereas if I'm not attentive to my inner world, even in the complexity of human relations, and I just blurt something out or I repress that in some way, then I'm not left clean. I have a residue. It's like the fire that we had last week. We still have another fire to do. There's something left over. There's some remorse or some regret or whatever. And then I carry that. Then I carry that memory. Well, why did I say that? And I should have done this and I should have done that. And why did she say that? And why did he say that? And the mind just keeps creating this ego, this sense of self. So this is a lovely skill, isn't it, as a human being, to be aware. And to be aware at the kind of many levels of being that we function, not just the social level or just the functional level where we don't spill the porridge on the floor. That's important too, but actually at the inner level of the movement of consciousness. So we have that capacity first and foremost of restraint. We can restrain or we can refrain from acting out unskillful things. We're not repressing them. We're saying, well, it's just the way it is right now. And again, it's the same like in the sitting, the 45 minutes of sitting. Most sittings, people feel some kind of restlessness. Many times you start the sitting, you think, why did I ever start the sitting? You know, I should have done my whatever. And so there's restlessness there. But you kind of take responsibility for that. And with experience, you know, if I just hang in with the restlessness, my mind will settle. Right? Whereas if I don't, I'll just be more restless. So there's that kind of realization. You can be with something negative, not act it out, and yet not repress it. There's a middle way. So the same in human relation. I can be with a feeling of annoyance, not act on it, not repress it. Now that doesn't, you know, I can still, if something is very, very difficult and unfair and so on, I can speak strongly. I can be assertive. It's not a passive attitude. It's just knowing what's skillful, knowing what's unskillful, and making skillful choices, so that I don't have all these residues and regrets and remorse. So that we call restraint from activity which is based upon intentions which would be egotistical, unskillful, fearful, angry, those kind of things. And that is a part of memory, you know, because the reason we feel these things is because that's the way the mind has been conditioned. And we find certain people maybe annoy us, or you know, we feel threatened by them. Like because I sit up here, I tend to be an authority figure. So you know, I feel like a teddy bear myself. But you know, people will look at me like the sergeant major, or the God, or the father, or the elder brother, and I can sometimes see in them, well, I'm not that actually, that's your mind. But this is the way history works, this is the way memory works sometimes. We project. Right? We project onto life certain exaggerations, certain distortions of perception, things like that. And those take some time to get used to or to understand as actually they're not real. They're not really real. And so that's part of memory. Part of memory is the distortion of the present moment. Is the distortion of the way I see other people or the way I see myself. All of us have probably suffered from overly self-critical attitudes. Right, where we do some minor thing and the kind of critical tyrant within us just berates us all the time, and someone else says to us, you're all right, it's not a problem. And you walk away, no, they don't really understand. It's sort of inner tyranny, inner voices. Those are distortions of history, distortions of perception, distortions of conditioning. And they can seem very real. They can seem very real. And in our contemplative and meditative practices, more and more realizing that anything which isn't friendly, which is kind of in that vein of being hostile and aggressive and critical and so on, is not to be believed in. There's a difference between evaluating my own life and saying, well, I really like to direct it a bit more to the right, I'm going a bit too much to the left, or vice versa. Doing that is skillful. It's a skillful analysis of one's own path. But the other, the one which isn't invested with friendliness, is not to be believed. So as we begin to understand these negative energies, we continually make choices which no longer perpetuate the negativities of history, the distortions of our childhood conditioning or our karmic conditioning or whatever model you like. You know, there are many models to define the present moment. You can have the chemical model, you can have the child upbringing model, you can have the crime and punishment model of karma, or you can look at it many ways. But there is the sense of us interpreting life through a whole set of perceptions which sometimes are not really valid. they're not that accurate. And I think I know it myself, I can see all kinds of exaggerations of worry sometimes, say, you know, that's not that way. And I can see, oh, that's just the way the mind likes to exaggerate. And the more I see that, I say, oh yeah, yeah, that's just what this perceptual process that I'm involved with has been conditioned to do. And I can see how, oh, that's not accurate. That's not accurate. And those kinds of inner discoveries then kind of shine a light on where our suffering is, shine a light on the various delusions that we suffer from. So that's a negative part of history, the negative part of memory, say. But there's also a very wholesome part of and positive part of memory and perception and history. And that's what I suggested in the beginning of this meditation, where we can also evoke very wholesome things. I can evoke like feelings of gratitude or kindness or love or joy or peacefulness or beauty. And there's all these very calming places of abiding that we've all been to. All of us have been to places where our minds are calm, are settled, are open, are connected, are joyous, right? Now, if we just try to reproduce those, you know, if I just try to manufacture joy, it doesn't work, does it? I just try to, you know, sit down and I want to get that joy back, or I want to get. Then it's just a sense of ego trying to become something. Well, that's not it. Whereas to evoke something is a much more, it's a creative thing rather than an egotistical thing. If I sit, as a way of speaking, say, if I sit down and I want the joy I had in that meditation 2 months ago. Most of us have experienced the frustration of that. You can't repeat it. Why? Because I'm coming from a place of greed and desire. And then that greed and desire to get joy or peace then also becomes the aversion to that which is not joy or peace. So I enter into this war zone, inner struggle. But to evoke something, I can do that, and that's a skill that we can develop. But to evoke something, I first have to comprehend. Well, what is it like now? You know, where am I at right now? I have to take stock. I have to be present, right? And then I can then from that sense of presence, I can see what the mind is producing, what the body is feeling. And right away, that's evoking an attitude of presence and awareness and acceptance, right away. Now that, I'm not trying to repeat mindfulness from some past experience, I'm remembering to be mindful. And that's another idea around remembering, is that we remember the present moment. It sounds odd to remember presence. But the word sati in our tradition, which is some sense is mindfulness and so on, sati has this sense of remembering, right? But not the kind of remembering which is negative and egotistical, but the remembering which is wholesome. So I remember that this is the way things are now. I remember to feel the body, say. I remember to notice the heart. I recollect. And that's what we mean by contemplation, really. The contemplative person remembers the Dharma, remembers the truth of the way things are. And the more we do that, the more we become adept at that, the more we become skillful at that. So then, what can I remember? Well, I can first of all and foremost, I can remember what it really feels like to be present. Like just to listen to the swallows, to hear the end of the rain, to feel my elbow. These are simple things, they're always there. But I need to take time to remember to be present. And so in our life of in a life which is always caught up with consumption, consuming ideas or consuming experiences or always taking in, we quite often don't give time for just the simple presence of life. Just that. So we need to remember that. And that's skillful use of remembering. And then within that capacity for skillful use of remembering, we can also bring forth wholesome states of mind. So I suggested remembering someone, evoking the feeling of connectedness, and abiding with that. Now sometimes you can't do that. You know, it's just like maybe the mind's too confused, or you're trying too hard to get metta practice or whatever, but you can always remember this is the way things are. That's the beauty of it. You can always come back to that, because it's not a particular kind of experience. It's just knowing this experience. It's not a demand that you feel anything. So even if you can't feel friendly to the some very difficult emotion, you can just know it. And in a sense, that is the beginning of friendliness. And the beginning of friendliness is acceptance, isn't it? It's like entering into life as it presents itself. So as we become more adept at knowing our inner world and understanding the skillful use of remembering and the negative aspects of memory and conditioning and habit and addiction and all those things, as we see those differences, what we find is then those we find that some of the negative things that get triggered in us are the path to peace. Right? So the worldly way to look at it was, if I didn't have any of these negative things pushing my buttons, so if this person wasn't at the office, and that cousin of mine didn't come for Christmas, and blah 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 blah, right? And if I didn't have bad knees, and if I won the lotto or whatever, then I would be happy. So the idea is, like, if I can get all the people, all the situations perfect, and get rid of all those things which are imperfect, then I'll be happy. Of course, that's living in la-la land. It doesn't happen. Another way to look at it is that this situation which has made me upset, or this situation which has brought forth great grief, or this person who gets up my nose, or whatever, that is a kind of darkness and heaviness and conflict and suffering in my own heart, that if I take that on board with mindfulness, it will lead to peace. It will lead to a liberation of that very quality. And that's lovely. That's lovely, because it's taking the very stuff of life and conflict and suffering, and it's using it as, we say, manure for the Bodhi tree. Right? It's the food of enlightenment. But it'll only work if we have these tools in place. The tools of awareness and the tools of non-attachment, of not grasping. If those aren't in place, what happens with those situations where our buttons get pressed, the size of the button just gets bigger. And the frequency of it being triggered gets greater, right? So we see people who don't understand their inner world, they just get more irritated, or more biased, or more racist, or more frightened, because they're not really aware of these things. They believe in them, and they become more and more exaggerated in that negativity. So this is lovely, really, if you think about it, that the very thing which the person, so let's say a person has really upset me for some reason, some discord or whatever. Now, and that person just is in my life. I have no choice about it. And I know that I'm going to have to meet this person again. If I then suggest to myself, remember to be aware of your heart when you start talking with this person. Try to be aware of your guts when you start talking to this person. Remember what your heart feels like when you interchange with this person. Now, that is like programming my memory. Right? It's what we call intention, isn't it? I make volitional thought, intentional thought, about trying to be more aware in this conflicting situation. So, because that's a difficulty in conflict situations, the overwhelming. It might not be a person, it might be a certain kind of emotion which just comes up and confuses me. It might be some grief which comes up again at an anniversary, or you know, there's all kinds of ways that we feel suffering. But the suggestion then of remembering is that, like, the use of intention and determination to be more aware of an area where I tend to get lost or confused. So then the situation arises, and the person is there, and there's the exchange of the person, and there's the same old pattern comes up, the same old negative pattern, right? But now, you know, through having contemplated this and really wanting to do this, I realize that negative pattern now with this person is a negative pattern I've had with other people. You know, if it's not with this person, it's another person. And if I can just bear witness to this negative pattern and not feed it, just let it come through the body and through the emotions and try as much as possible to practice right speech, then that negative pattern will lose its power until that negative pattern will not dominate my mind. And so this very situation is the source of peace, if I can practice with it, right? And that's lovely. I mean, again, switches it all around. So in the darkness, there's light. In the fear, there's courage. Right? In the anger, there's love. That's that kind of language that we have. But it's not so easy. You know, if you can just, you don't just kind of say that to a person that's angry, oh, there's love in the middle of that. Probably they'll stab you to death or something. But if you get the principle of this is where I need to work, then, and you understand what the work is, a lot of the work is just being really, really patient and really, really attentive and really, really careful, then afterwards, after a few of these interchanges, right, you begin to see, wow, that pattern and that mode of suffering is more and more liberated from consciousness. It's not part of the process of consciousness. It's no longer a part of my history, at least not a part of the dominant history that I'm experiencing as a human being. So my memory patterns now have been cleansed of that, or have not gone that way. They've gone another path. They've gone towards mindfulness and acceptance and compassion, and that's freedom, right? Freedom which has come through a lot of hard work, a lot of maturity and self-responsibility and wisdom and understanding. I understand how that works. And the other option, of course, is to the kind of heedless option would be to blame people or blame yourself or run away and so on. And sometimes blame is appropriate. Like if someone's being really abusive and immoral, then blame is appropriate. You can't do that. That's not right. So it's, you know, it's appropriate there. But the suffering I experience, we always try to say, no, you've got to take responsibility for that. Yeah. Where this doesn't work is where it's overpowering. So if a person is just getting overwhelmed by some negative pattern, then they can burn out. And so it's not an absolute. You know, it's, you know, you have to do this all the time. But you can see that if there's enough mindfulness, if there are the right suggestions, that these situations can be liberating situations. If they become overwhelming, then of course we just fall into more negativity. So sometimes strategic retreat is important. You know, sometimes like if the speech is just getting off and we'll just go away. Sorry, got to go to the toilet, time out or whatever. Because then we exacerbate those negative patterns and we carry them around as more history, more regret, more remorse, which creates a more sense of ego, oh, I'm a terrible person, or that person's a complete fool or whatever it might be. Now, the teachings of the Buddha, the way we try to approach this sort of practice is by being responsible but not taking things personally. So what do I mean? Being responsible, this is certainly taking place in my heart and mind, in this bit of consciousness which I'm experiencing. But not taking personally is what we mean by that is that this isn't really who I am. It's not me. It's not mine. It's just simply a pattern, a process, which has been a part of this conscious momentum because of history. So there's a kind of context where this has arisen, and that context in the future will be different, but this kind of history can be addressed, can be let go of. And that's what we mean by not taking it personally. When we take it personally, what we mean in Buddhism is like, I'm a bad person, I have a great anger problem. I'm a terrible person, I have all this anger, I have to work on my anger. Whereas in Buddhism we'd say, no, anger arises in a certain context. It stays for a while, and then it ceases. And it's those contexts where our buttons get pressed, where we just have to not believe in it. Whereas the sort of mindset which says, I am someone who has an anger problem, is a sense of self the Buddha said was not really skillful. Now, I'm not just splitting hairs here, because you have to be responsible. Like, irresponsibility would say, anger's not self, and I punch you in the face. I just, you know, no sense of responsibility. Whereas the other, I am someone who is angry, is not actually true. Because anger isn't just me, it's a whole set of conditions. They come, they manifest, they do their thing, and then they cease. And then in that cessation, there's no anger. Even if you're not working on it, you know, there's joy, there's happiness, there's sorrow, there's fear, and there's... So, am I really that anger? And Buddhists would say, no, that's not who you really are. Your real home is awareness. And awareness is something that can open you to something very profound, very peaceful. And the problem is not so much the anger, it's that the awareness gets lost, and we get our attention gets preoccupied with the anger. And then we preoccupy that attention even more, by thinking, I shouldn't be angry, I'm a terrible person, I have to work on my anger, and I'm not going to get angry, and shut up! Oop, I'm angry again, oh, I'm a terrible person, and it just goes on and on and on. Whereas stepping away, so this is anger. Anger feels this way. Now that's different. It's not ego-based. It's not creating a self around it. And this sense of non-attachment and knowing this movement as just a movement is a part of the way we do this kind of work. So whether it's fear or anger or sadness, it's the I sense in it which gets wrapped in it, which makes it much more complicated and makes it much more real. And the more one is able to see this is not really a personality problem, it's just conditioned stuff. That's all it is. I'm not a bad person. It's just that way. So you can feel annoyed at someone you love and not dump it on them, you don't have to feel guilty. It's just the context as annoyance has come up into your heart. Whereas if you take it personally, then you feel guilty for feeling annoyed. I should love this person all the time. Not possible. I should always be affectionate and kind and sensitive and loving and caring and all the time. You know, 100% of the time. It's not human. Because sometimes the person you love the deepest, you just don't want to talk with them. Because your mind has another, you know, has another kind of agenda. Now, if you take it personally, then we tend to create an ideal. Like, I should love my kids or my parents or whoever, my partner, all the time. Can't do it. So then maybe you blame the person, you blame yourself, but you can be friendly to all the inner attitudes. So when you feel annoyed at someone that you love, don't be threatened by that. Just don't act on it. Don't speak on it. And just be with, you know, trust in that, trust in the annoyance. And that will take you to a more and more open space, a more and more heart space. Where the other, where the annoyance comes up and you either blurt it out or you repress it, it just creates more history, more patterns, more residue, more business, more karma. It just goes on and on and on. So the suggestion in Buddhist practice is to, like, to as one lives one's life and one sees certain areas where certain kinds of situations produce suffering, is to really go into that and to get a feeling for it. This is suffering, you know, this is conflict, this is alienation or whatever, and to begin to just witness to that in a very open way. Then these things have a chance to cease, and that openness of mind begin to see that's where your real home is. The other way of constantly identifying and attaching to these negative histories creates a very kind of constricted, alienated sense of self, which is endless. It just goes on and on and on. So it takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of patience to bear with these things. Wisdom, too, I think. You understand, well, the only way out is through non-attachment. You just have to witness it. So then you begin to, like, really bear witness to difficult things and yet live a good life. Difficult things, yet practice right speech. Great challenge. It's a really, really neat challenge. The freedom of the heart from that, then, is not a freedom which is manipulated or that it's not a freedom which is just rearranged because you changed the deck chairs on the Titanic, as it were. And it's not kind of rearranged, it's like really free, because the mind is no longer conditioned and conflicted by these sort of historical things. All right, leave that for you to contemplate.
Andamayam dhammakataya sadhu karang dharamase sadhu 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 anumodami.